The following presentation is brought to you by The Realm Network.
Mr. Media, I'll talk to writer Chuck Dixon, co-creator of Batman's greatest foe in comics and movies, Bane, as well as author of the thrilling adventure novels such as SEAL Team 6, Bad Times, and Levon Cade. His latest comics work includes both Joe Frankenstein, yep, you heard that right, and Winterworld for IDW. Plus, I just learned SpongeBob SquarePants for United Plankton. Stick around. We're live at Emerald City Comics, 4902 113th Avenue North in Clearwater, Florida. And I've got a few people looking at me who know Chuck, but who are wondering if my face is familiar from an old Wanted poster somewhere. So much media, so little time. Who keeps track of it all? That would be me. This is Bob Andelman, and this is Mr. Media Interview. You know, MrMedia.com, MrMedia.com. Stop by and check it out. There are more than 1,000 archived celebrity and pop culture interviews for your listening and viewing pleasure. Johnny. Mr. Media is recorded live before a studio audience. Hey, wait a minute. This is not my beautiful living room. Who are these people? Who are these all these comic books? Holy cow, we're live. Live, I tell you, at Neil Johnson's Emerald City Comics, 4902 113th Avenue North in Clearwater, Florida. Just minutes north of the new media capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida. Thank you, Mr. Zoom. Before I introduce my guest, writer Chuck Dixon, I want to tell you about the people who made it possible for Mr. Media to leave the living room and venture out in public today. And no, they were not parole officers. We're recording this show at the new Emerald City Comics at 4902 113th Avenue North in Clearwater, Florida. If you love comic books and collectibles, this may be the biggest and best store of its kind in the entire southeastern United States. It is a warehouse store in the way that the Home Depot or the Sports Authority is. It is enormous, stocked with everything you could ever want or need, and staffed by men and women who know what they're talking about. So drop in and shop today. Mention you saw it on Mr. Media. For more information, visit the Emerald City Comics site, emeraldcitycomics.com, or give them a call, 727-398-2665. That's 727-398-2665. All right. Now, let me tell you about my guest. If you were building a fantasy league team of modern comic book writers, Chuck Dixon would have to be on it. Sure, he's best known as the co-creator of Batman's most fearsome enemy, Bane. Sorry, Joker fans. Bane's first appearance, of course, came during the stunning Nightfall series in 1993, but that just scratches the surface of the man's decades-long career, which started way back in February 1984. February 1984? Sound good? All right. You can find Dixon's byline everywhere, from The Punisher to The Simpsons, and from Superman to The Savage Sword of Conan. He's produced long runs on the Batman family of titles, including Detective Comics, Robin, The Huntress, and Birds of Prey, as well as Green Arrow, G.I. Joe, The Nam, and Airboy, or The Nom, if you prefer. But wait, there's more. Scooby-Doo, Transformers, and yes, A Nightmare on Elm Street. He also adapted J.R.R. Tolkien's The Hobbit for a best-selling graphic novel. Dixon also holds a very special place in the history of the Mr. Media podcast. He was my first video guest back in 2007. That interview, in which we talked about his work for Bongo Comics on The Simpsons, has been viewed more than 100,000 times online. Currently, Dixon is writing two new series for IDW, Joe Frankenstein and Winterworld, and as I mentioned earlier, SpongeBob SquarePants for United Plankton. That is so cool. He's also the author of three ongoing fiction series, Bad Times, Levon Cade, and SEAL Team 6. Chuck Dixon, welcome back to Mr. Media.
I'm so happy to be back.
I'm glad to have you here. So I'm thinking Charles Schulz had Joe Cool, you have Joe Frankenstein. I personally think your guy is way cooler.
it's a creator-owned property that Graham Nolan and I put together. We took it to IDW. They liked it. And it's really the heart and soul of it is Graham. He's such a huge Universal Monsters fan. And the idea, you know, started with him. And thankfully, he brought me on board to help contribute.
How do you go from having Frankenstein's monster to naming him Joe?
Well, in this story, Joe Frankenstein, the title character, is he's actually a pizza delivery boy. He's a slacker from Buffalo, New York, who learns that he's the heir to the Frankenstein legacy. Not only that, but the monster has been watching over him since the day he was born as a sort of guardian, trying to safeguard the life of the last Frankenstein.
So this is all kind of based in reality.
Yeah. I mean, I think it happened to Graham, actually.
does the monster come with any of the detail of, you know, the movies or the books, or do you start from scratch with him? How do you do this?
Well, I mean, everybody knows who Frankenstein's monster is, so we start with the premise that everybody already knows who he is. We don't delve too much into his origin, except, you know, a couple of flashbacks. We reintroduce the bride. There's a werewolf. There are vampires. There's the whole, basically, it's an homage to the old Universal movies, updating them for a new audience, to our mind. You know, that version of the classic monsters.
And the bride is not a pleasant person.
No, she's horrible. She's the worst ex-wife who ever lived or died. As she tells the monster, you know, we were made for each other, which they were. But he just doesn't see it that way. And she's the cause of all of his problems, as, you know, anybody who has an ex-wife knows very well.
I only have a current wife. I don't know. And I'm told I will only have one wife. So I'll take your word for it. I will take your word for it. Chuck, tell me, when you start a series like this, do you start it with like a finish line in mind, or are you thinking in terms of it going to infinity and beyond?
You want to throw everything you have at it at first. You don't want to hold anything back. But you know, as you work on it and the characters become real to you, you begin to imagine future stories. So, you know, in Joe Frankenstein, the first miniseries is complete. The story in itself, but of course we leave it open that there will be sequels, and we leave, you know, little dangling subplots that we can pick up later on.
Now, your other new series is Winterworld, which it struck me anyway that it seemed actually even a little darker than Frankenstein. Can you talk a little about the series?
Well, it's a series that I first did in the late 80s with Jorge Zaffino. We created it together, another creator-owned project, and it's set in the world of the future. Probably a generation from now, in which the world is frozen over. It's a perpetual winter from pole to pole. And it's the story of Scully. He's a traitor. He travels in this, you know, brutal environment. And he comes to adopt or become the protector of a 14-year-old girl named Wynn. And together they sort of face all the odds, you know, hostile environment and the horrible people that they meet. As Wynn says, why is everyone we meet crazy? And they're searching for Wynn's parents, Wynn's home where she came from. And it's dark, it's brutal, it's pretty nasty.
This from the man who did The Simpsons.
Well, you know, you gotta have versatility or you can't last.
How different is it for you to do like creator-owned series versus parachuting in and out of like a Marvel or a DC or someone else's property?
Well, my first thing when I'm offered a job is, you know, give me a day to think about it. You know, can I bring something to this property? I mean, I don't want to take on a job that I can't invest myself in. You know, is there some heart and soul to this? You know, yeah. And with licensed properties, it's usually, did I really like this when I was a kid? You know, so I can get into it. And but there's really no difference between creator-owned and licensed characters, except, you know, obviously with the creator-owned, you know, nobody's telling me what to write.
Which pays better?
It depends on the spin of the wheel. The licensed stuff is paid better as far as royalties and ancillary stuff. You know, I haven't really had a creator-owned thing yet that's clicked outside of the comic media.
But you've done enough of them that you know going in what it's going to be worth to you in your wallet, I guess.
Well, yeah, and what prompted me and IDW to return to Winter World was that we have a deal with Xbox for like an 8-episode television event that Xbox has in pre-production now. So, you know, that's a spin of the wheel that may pay off.
Do you look at something like this or Joe Frankenstein with an eye toward, this is modern media, it's the 21st century, are you thinking with everything that you create and work on, could this sell to TV, could this sell to film, could this sell to cartoons or something?
Well, I mean, you first do it because you love it. I mean, you know, Winter World for me was an itch I had to scratch. Joe Frankenstein started the same way with Graham, and then he brought me on to help scratch it. you know, but it's, you know, you do it because you love it. I mean, I can't just sit here and go, well, this might be popular. I mean, I write what I would want to read. I write what I'm interested in. And if someone else likes it, you know, and they connect with it, that's great, you know. But, you know, as far as the ancillary stuff and other media, you have to get a hard shell. You have to harden your heart because everything you do, you're going to hear from some producer and they're going to talk to you about how wonderful it's all going to be. And you're just going to be swimming in cash. And, you know, it never, ever happens, you know, 99% of the time, you know, because there's so much property out there. But they'll be enthusiastic for a few phone calls and then you'll never hear from them again.
So you gotta catch that first option check, enjoy it while it lasts, and not expect anything after it.
Yeah. You just gotta get off the phone and forget about it and go back to work, going back to doing what you like to do. I mean, I like doing what I do, sitting in a room by myself, just making stuff up. So I'm fine no matter what they want to do with the material.
The last time we spoke, you were deep into a run on The Simpsons. How long did you wind up working on that?
You know, it was like one of those things where I would pitch. I guess I was doing like 6 or 8 issues a year at my high point. But, you know, I did quite a bit of stuff for them.
How many years did that last?
I guess it was 6 or 7 years.
That's not a bad run for anything, right?
No, it's good. I mean, you know, I think I come in second only to Ian Boothby, who, you know, has written an enormous amount of really terrific stuff for them. But, you know, I'm sort of a tail end Charlie there in second.
How did that have anything to do with you doing SpongeBob now? Is there a connection?
No, there really isn't, because SpongeBob, Chris Duffy, who was an editor at DC back when I was at DC, he was doing Nickelodeon comics and then moved exclusively to SpongeBob and basically put a call out to everybody he had ever worked with, like, I need a lot of material. And he knew I could do funny because I'd done The Simpsons. And I was conversant with the show because I have kids at just the right age. You know, I watched a lot of SpongeBob with them. So I knew the characters and I liked them, and it was something I felt I could contribute to. And it's the same situation that I had with The Simpsons. I come up with some kind of wacky idea, and I email Chris, and, you know, he either thinks it's funny or it doesn't, and we go from there.
How different are the characters to write for?
They're not that different because, you know, you think it's funny and it's all silliness and everything else. But you know, the success of The Simpsons and the success of SpongeBob rely on the fact that both shows have heart and you really do care. I mean, when SpongeBob is like tearing himself apart over some inanity, you still worry that, you know, he's going to end the episode sad or hurt in some way. So there's a lot of emotional content there. It's a lot of fun to write. You know, there's a lot there to base the jokes off of. It's not just joke. There's actual humor there, and there's a difference between comedy and humor. And there's a lot of humor to SpongeBob.
Would it be an unfair comparison to say that writing for those might be similar to writing for DC comics in the 60s, where continuity wasn't a big deal? You would just write a story, and then next issue would write another story and didn't have to relate back to what you had previously written?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, both are liberating. I mean, Simpsons actually makes fun of its own continuity gaffes. So, you know, you can actually lean into, you know, continuity paradoxes. SpongeBob, it's totally whatever you want it to be. I mean, it's completely free. I mean, you have a premise where they all live under the ocean, but it's simply never referenced. I mean, they'll have campfires under the ocean. So it's like you're utterly free to divorce yourself from continuity, reality, or any other constraints when you're writing SpongeBob.
Chuck, I was thinking that, you know, I make my living as a writer of nonfiction type stuff. Biographies, and I like to think that I can adapt to different formats, but there's two types of writings that completely escape me that I just can't, I don't know, it's like a mental block. Songwriting and comic book writing. it's hard for me to, if you write songs, you have to be able to equate the music and the words. I can't do that. I can't make the connection. And with the comic books, you have to create, you have to think in terms of the words and the visuals. And I'm wondering, was that ever difficult for you to start at first? And do you ever struggle with it even this after doing it this long?
Well, my mutant ability is telling stories in static pictures. I mean, I've always been interested in comics, even before I could read. So the comics medium to me is probably like the music medium to Johnny. I mean, it's just like it's something he does, he loves it. You know, yeah, you got to practice and you got to work at it, but, you know, there's that burning desire to do it. And that drives you forward till you're, you know, hopefully eventually doing it right. And it's the kind of writing that I always fall back on. Even when I'm prose writing, I kind of think in comic book terms. How would this break down at the comic book pages? And what images do I want the reader to see in their mind? Just like I have to write images for the artist to see in his mind when he's drawing.
Were there any characters that have ever given you fits of, you know, where you've been like, I don't know how to write for them?
There's been situations in, you know, the editor's demand. You know, like, we want this. You know, the old Julie Schwartz thing, you know, everybody's afraid to say Superman's name. Why? Well, they don't pay me to write this junk, you know. So I've had situations. Like I said, I give myself 24 hours before I say yes or no to a job. If I can't get my head around a character in that time, I just say no.
And ultimately, what do you think is the secret to your success? Is it good looks? Is it...
It's staying way ahead of schedule. Always stay way ahead of schedule. And then when new jobs come in, you have an opportunity to say yes because you've bought yourself time. And that's, I think, really my reliability has been my strongest point. I mean, I got a call from an editor once who said, I need a script. I won't say the character. I need a script in 3 days. And I said, okay, fine. Let me come up with an idea. You know, I like this character. I can do it. I've never written them before. And I said, well, what happened to the regular writer? Did they get sick? Was there an accident? And they said, no, we hired a new writer for this character, but he doesn't have any ideas yet.
God. All right. Wow. Well, look, on that note, let's take a quick break. This is Bob Andelman, and you are watching or listening to the Mr. Media Interview with comic book writer and novelist Chuck Dixon, recorded live at Emerald City Comics, 4902 113th Avenue North, in sunny Clearwater, Florida. We'll be right back after this musical interlude by the Johnny Zoom Hi-Fi Show. Play it, Johnny. We'll be right back. This is Bob Andelman, and you are listening to and watching the Mr. Media interview with comic book writer and novelist Chuck Dixon, recorded live at Emerald City Comics, 4902 113th Avenue North in sunny Clearwater, Florida. We just enjoyed a musical break with Mr. Media's one-man house band, the Johnny Zoom Hi-Fi Show. I tell him to take a bow, but he's pointed the other way. There we go. All right, let's return to Chuck. Chuck, so I talked to this other guy, this other comic book writer a few days ago, a guy I think you know, Stephen Grant. Yeah. And like you, he is often associated with aggressive, take-no-shit characters. You both have done well-regarded runs on The Punisher, for example. Are there any parallels or comparisons to be made, pro or con, between you?
Between Stephen Grant and I?
Yeah.
I can't think of one. I think we both have gray hair.
That's true. You do. You guys both do have gray hair.
He grayed earlier than me, though. I think we're the same around the same age. No, there's not.
It was just interesting to me that you guys overlap, not at the same time, but you've both done a lot of the same characters. You both have this reputation for taking on characters that are fairly aggressive. They don't talk a lot in some cases. Thinking Batman or Bane, for example, or Punisher. I couldn't think of anything else that you two had in common.
In comic writers, they don't associate with each other much. We're just a suspicious bunch. You know, oh, he's gonna take my idea. Back in the day, we were all in competition for the same title. So you didn't have a lot of, writers don't have a lot of writer friends. All the comic book artists, they all know each other. They're all like a big club. They could all live in the same house at the beach, you know. But writers, we're like off by ourselves. Well, it's the nature of a writer to be alone.
Is there some reason that you do a lot of this very, well, violent characters, violent stories? Is there something, you know, in your nature? Is it something you've been drawn to? Is it something you started with, or you just kind of found yourself doing over time?
I'm just a really violent guy. In fact, I'm having a hard time containing myself right now. But yeah, as you can tell by my demeanor, I'm just exploding with rage.
Well, you had Bane in a headlock earlier.
Yes, I did. Yeah. I did. I got tired of that guy. He's always around. I don't know. I mean, I always say that I love writing Punisher. I associate with the Punisher, and I don't know what that says about me. I honestly don't know what that says about me, except that I must use the wrong part of my brain. I've always been attracted to the really direct kind of characters. You know, I like detective fiction and stuff like that. I don't want to write it. I want to write about the guy who finds out who the killer is, goes to his house, and kills him. And there's enough of the audience that enjoys that kind of story that thankfully, you know, I have somebody that will read my stuff.
Chuck Dixon, man of vengeance.
Yes. don't cross me.
Is that something you've come to, later in life? Or did you, I mean, when you started writing comics 30-some years ago, was that already in your head?
Yeah, the more direct characters. I like characters who were already pre-constructed before the story begins. You know, they always talk about character arc and development and things like that. That's all wonderful. But, you know, John Wayne never needed his character developed. You know, Clint Eastwood does not change from the beginning to the end of a Dirty Harry movie. You know, they're elemental furies, if you will, to get all pretentious about it. Characters like Conan or Dirty Harry, that just sort of come into the story fully molded and make things happen.
You've got a 23-year-old son who was 14 the last time we got together for this. And you've been writing comics and now fiction the whole his whole life. I'm kind of curious, was there ever a time during his youth, you know, maybe like 6, 7 through 13, where you thought twice about maybe a title that you would take on just because of your son, or either because... I'm thinking about decisions I made when my kid was in middle school, not to take on anything that would cause the kid trouble or at school with either teachers or other kids, or I don't know. Did you ever think into any of those terms?
Not really. I mean, you know, the thought crossed my mind. You know, I want to do some stuff my kid can read, which for the most part, my superhero stuff was all ages. You know, so I didn't mind them picking up that stuff. You know, the more dark and grim stuff, you say, well, you know, if they want to look at that later. You know, back in the day, there were so many comp comics coming into the house that, you know, he had so much more to look at than just my stuff. And I let both of my kids pick out what they wanted to read. And, you know, and a lot of times it wasn't my stuff anyway, which that's fine with me. But, yeah, I mean, you know, what do you do? I mean, that's how I made a living. I had to go where the market bore, you know. There's plenty of people in fields where, you know, that would be questionable for their kids to see what they're doing or know what they're doing. But, you know, you got to keep doing it to put food on the table.
You know, for my money, and I think for the money of a lot of the people who came to see you and get their books and their comics and their cans of soda signed today, and it's been an interesting day sitting next to you, let me just say. The Nightfall and Nightquest run on Batman, which introduced Bane and the literal backbreaking of Batman, was certainly one of the most compelling in the character's long history. I have to be alongside, say, The Killing Joke, which the Joker kills Robin, and Frank Miller's Dark Knight. Can you kind of take us behind the scenes, as you did earlier, with some people who were asking you about it here, and talk a little about the creation of that series? I gather it started with Denny O'Neil, but...
Yeah, at the time I was writing a lot of Robin. I was doing Robin miniseries, and that seemed to be my niche, and they invited me up to this Bat Summit. I'd never been to anything like that. This is back when the comic books themselves actually made money so they could afford things like this. And so I went up to this retreat, this Batman Summit, up the Hudson on a former estate. The place was amazing, all the food you could eat. They gave us fabulous rooms and put us in this meeting room that looked like Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson would have been at home there. And that's where Denny laid out Nightfall. He laid out like 2 years of continuity, you know, the high points. And then we spent the next couple of days breaking that down using whiteboards, you know, that assistant editors would write down what we said. And we broke down it issue by issue, a year and a half's worth of continuity and who would write what. And it was myself, Alan Grant, and Doug Mensch, because we were the core Batman writers at the time.
Had you ever laid out any series that far in advance, in that detail?
I don't think anybody had. And that was a point Denny kept making. He thought we were breaking new ground. You know, the readers would never know what we were doing, but he thought we were you know, in fresh territory as far as comic books went, to tell this grand epic and have it figured out so far in advance. Not only that, but the denouement, what would happen after that? Because we were just dealing with, you know, Bane, Batman getting his back broken, and Batman and a new Batman coming in. You know, at that point, we were not dealing with, you know, the aftermath of that, you know, the return of Bruce Wayne. So, you know, and he was right. What we did was groundbreaking and in the end, extremely profitable for DC.
Now, Nightfall followed by maybe a year or so the death of Superman, I'm thinking?
I guess Superman was still technically dead when we started working on Nightfall. I know this because I was building a house at the time, and the construction crew all came down to ask me why I killed Superman. They knew I worked in comics, and they assumed that, you know, comics were done by three or four guys in a room somewhere. So, we were like concurrently running. I think Superman was back by the time our story actually hit the stands.
Chuck, why did you kill Superman?
Oh, man, you know, that guy, I mean, what can you do?
What could you do with him alive?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's a question I'd like to answer someday, but I'll never get the opportunity. I think Superman's a far more interesting character than people lend him credit for.
You think Superman's a more interesting character?
Yeah. There's really a lot to him. He's, you know, there's a lot of basic stuff there. He's an orphan. He just wants to belong. He's like the Uber nerd, you know? He's not like everybody else. And, you know, I would like to answer the questions of why he feels, you know, like he needs to be Clark Kent.
Let's talk about Bane for a minute. You co-created him. I want to make sure I share enough credit there by saying co-created. He was featured in the last Batman movie to date. What did you think? I have my own opinion, but I'm curious to know what you thought of Tom Hardy as Batman and the way he was portrayed.
Well, it was nice that they had an actor playing him for once. It was sad that half of his face was covered, so he couldn't fully emote. But it was a worthy effort. They certainly presented him as a badass, which I'm grateful for, because in the end he became a household name, which that's wonderful for me.
Got a little change out of that?
Yeah, it does okay. It does okay. He keeps appearing as action figures and in video games. He was a pasta shape in SpaghettiOs once, so he's everywhere.
Did you imagine that he would have a British accent when you created him?
No, he did not. I thought he would sound like Henry Silva, who did his voice in the first cartoon appearance.
The minute Tom Hardy opened his mouth in the movie, I went, "What? Huh?" I don't know. They lost me right there as soon as I heard the accent on the character. I just thought, why is Bane speaking with a British accent?
Yeah, I don't know. You know, I don't even know if it was a British accent. I don't know what that accent was. It was something.
Yeah.
There was a little Eastern European in there. I hear he based it on a boxer or something from somewhere in Eastern Europe. I don't know.
Well, I know that what you really would like to talk about is your fiction, your novels. So let's veer over to that for a little bit. I'm always surprised that you've found the time to do that on top of the comics you're writing. Are you writing fewer comics these days, or are you just that? Is it having grown kids that allows you time to do more work?
Well, the comics industry sort of turned. The comics industry is going the way the music industry is going. It's all niche marketing and boutique sales and things like that. So the comic work I'm doing now, in addition to Winter World and Joe Frankenstein, is I'm doing a lot of motion comics. Which, if anybody in the audience doesn't know what a motion comic is, it's a comic book that you download digitally, and things in the panel are slightly animated or will move a little bit, you know. And sometimes there's sound, and even actors reading the voices and music. I have one out now based on the television show The Last Ship, which is free to download. This motion comic I'm doing. Graham Nolan and I are working on a line of motion comics for a company in India. I'm doing some for a company in UK. In addition to the print stuff. But, you know, it still leaves me time on my hands, you know, between jobs to attack the prose stuff.
And are we seeing the real you in SEAL Team 6 or Bad Times or Levon Cade more so than in comic books? So you feel more free to write the way you want to?
Comics is still my medium. I always joke with the publishers of the SEAL Team 6 books that they paid me to learn how to write novels. So I'm more comfortable. I'm real comfortable with the Levon Cade series. I feel like I've found a you know, my voice, for lack of a better term.
Is there anything you've been able to do in fiction that you always wanted to do in comics?
Well, not waiting for an artist is a big thing. I mean, I love working with artists. I love the collaborative meeting. I love comics. And I'm still as excited as the first day I ever worked on them. But the expense and the time, you know... I feel like with what I'm doing now with the novels is, you know, there's no gatekeeper. I don't need permission to write, and, you know, I do as much or as little as I want, and, you know, I can finish a book and it's literally on sale within 2 weeks.
And would you mind taking a minute and describing the Bad Times series and Levon Cade as well? Let's give you a good commercial here.
Well, Bad Times. I just happen to have one right here. The Bad Times series, it's up to its fourth volume, and it's about a team of former U.S. Army Rangers who are hired as mercenaries to go back in time, through a time machine, obviously, to rescue a science team. And, of course, going back in time creates more problems for them, enough problems for four books, coincidentally. But they travel to prehistoric Nevada, they travel to France at the time of the Franco-Prussian War. They travel to ancient Judea at the time of Christ. They travel to the ancient Aegean and fight Phoenician pirates. So it's basically a bunch of guys who are able to take 21st century tactics and weapons back in the past for them and take on all comers. And, of course, it's not as simple as that. Everything always goes wrong. But the series is selling well, has a core fan base. And, you know, I love writing them because it gives me an opportunity to do historical research and, you know, actually have a reason for doing it.
So I was going to ask you about the historical part. You enjoy that part.
Oh, yeah. I've always been a history nut. And these are sort of like toy soldier fantasies for me, you know, to visit obscure. The next one is set during the Taiping Rebellion in China, which most Americans have no idea. It was the bloodiest civil war in the history of mankind. And I can't wait to jump into that one.
Well, just one or two things left to ask you about. This one's very important. And I actually asked Stephen Grant this when I spoke to him. So this will be something in the future you can say. This will be something that you and Stephen Grant... This is something you and Stephen Grant can forever say that you had in common. Mr. Meaty asked you the same question. All right, you ready?
Yes.
Tell me something that an editor ever added to your storytelling that made a story better... And then tell me about a time when an editor utterly destroyed something that you wrote?
Oh, wow. There's too many examples.
Of which? Both?
Editors usually help. Well, that's if you have a good editor. They usually help you by saying, hey, why did this happen? Or why did you do that? You know, and it's like, well, you know, I really didn't think about that, but I should. So I'd say 90% of the time, editors' suggestions have improved things, you know, rather than made them worse. The one example I can think of, the one that leaps out at me for bad suggestion was, I handed in a script on a superhero book one time, and my editor, who I won't name, and I won't name the character, but my editor said, I was talking to him on the phone, you know, and he says, I was watching an episode of Wise Guy last night. This is how long ago this was. And he goes, and they did this, and they did that, and I really like that plot device. And I said, well, that's great. Well, could you work that into the character sometime? And I'm like, yeah, down the road. He goes, no, I mean rewrite the last script to include this plot device. In other words, completely rewrite it. And I just, I refused. I didn't last long on that book. But
I can't imagine why.
Yeah. But yeah, there's... In most cases, it's, you know, the editors, you know, they say, well, could you make this? Most editors, good editors, don't say, could you make this funnier or make this more dramatic? They'll say, hey, here's a way that you might be able to make this funnier, or here's a way to make this more dramatic. So, you know, my hat's off to editors. They have a tough job, and they've usually been my friend.
All right, so last question. This is a tough one. You ready?
Yes.
Marvel or DC, and why?
Marvel. And why? Because the characters they're more relatable than the DC. You know, I love both, and obviously I made a lot more money at DC than I ever did at Marvel, but I was a Marvel guy. I felt like I knew Spider-Man. I felt like I knew Ben Grimm. I never felt that Batman was knowable or anybody I would want to hang out with, you know, although yeah, I thought he was really cool. But they just seem more relatable. They seem more in touch with actual human nature than the DC characters who you know, when they were done well, were good. But when they were done poorly, were just sort of like, you know, one-dimensional.
Good answer. Fair answer. Thank you. All right, folks, listen. You can find collections of Chuck Dixon's work on everything from Batman and the Simpsons comics to novels such as SEAL Team 6, Bad Times, and Levon Cade. And, of course, everything in between in great bookstores everywhere, or you can order them right now at MrMedia.com. If you're watching us on MrMedia.com, below this video, you will see covers of Chuck's books. You can click on them right now, and maybe you can order them from Emerald City Comics, because we happen to be here, or maybe you order them online. That's up to you. I will not mention the name of any online stores that you can order them from today. Chuck, website you want to give out?
No, I got a Facebook page, like a Facebook author page, but my website, I got a Google blog spot. You can Google my name and it'll show up.
All right. So Facebook, what about Twitter?
Somebody does Twitter for me. I don't know anything about Twitter. Somebody takes my stuff and puts it on Twitter. I have people. I have a person.
Oh, okay. Chuck has people. Remember that. Chuck has people. Next time you approach him, don't be surprised if one of his people gets in between you. Chuck Dixon, thank you so much for joining us today on Mr. Media.
Always a pleasure, Bob.
All right. And folks, if you've enjoyed today's show, you can subscribe for free to Mr. Media via email, RSS, iTunes, Stitcher, whatever you got, and you'll never miss a show. You can also listen with a piece of string and a tin can in many parts of Kennett City, Florida. You can also follow Mr. Media on Facebook, Twitter, the Stitcher mobile app, or our YouTube and Vimeo video channels. Thank you so much for joining us today, and thanks again to Emerald City Comics for having us. I really appreciate everybody sharing a piece of their day with Mr. Media. And at that, Johnny Zoom, take us out.
during the interview, I'm just going to watch like this. Not to put you under any pressure.
Feel free to have some musical vamps like the things I say. Yeah. Every time I say Batman. There you go.
Hi, this is Buzz Burbank in the Buzz Burbank Newsroom, preparing for you another Buzz Burbank News and Comment. Do you like good stories? Boy, I sure do. I turn over a lot of stones each day to make sure I don't miss the best ones. Sure, some make me angry, and some make me sad, and some make me laugh, and isn't that what makes us human? I'm proud of the fact that I pack more news into my 10 or 15 minutes a day than the evening news does in a half hour. It's a free podcast at BuzzBurbank.com, or you can subscribe free at iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, or get it on any RSS device. It's like a newspaper for your head. It's Buzz Burbank News and Comment, another Realm Network presentation. Weekday mornings right here on the Realm Network.
Ladies and gentlemen, children of all ages, welcome to the George and Tony Entertainment Show. Prepare for awesome mediocrity.
We're the Cousin Oliver of the Realm Network. I'm George.
And I'm Tony.
And we're a weekly family-friendly podcast about pop culture.
From our point of view.
At RealmNetwork.com. The George and Tony Entertainment Show. From the Realm Network.
This is Snake. Do you read me, Otacon?
Loud and clear, Snake.
Did you listen to the latest episode of the Gaming Marathon on the Realm Network?
Of course. They really know their stuff about gaming, especially that Usid guy.
Yeah, but that Shirok guy is a real jerk. I don't like him.
Regardless, their reviews are spot on and they tell it like it is.
That's for sure.
What happened, Snake? Were you spotted?
Nah, it's just Lil Melser crying about the O's again.
Close call.
I better continue the search for Metal Gear, but keep listening to the Gaming Marathon each week.
You got it, Snake.
New every Monday afternoon right here on the Realm Network.
It's the Mark and Lowell Show.
Hi, this is Mark.
And this is Lowell. And if you're fans of Don and Mike, you may know who we are.
Our number one interns. You've met them on the show. They're the guys that ate all the junk and they were outside with each other holding hands with a sign that said that they loved each other wearing the dunce caps.
What you may not know is that we started out as fans back in their WAVA days.
Hi, Don and Mike. It's Mark and Lowell.
These are two guys that we once actually called them our proteges.
And now we have our own show, so we want you to give it a shot. Just check us out at the Realm Network, realmnetwork.com, or you can go to markandlowell.com.
Resistance is futile. It's the Mark and Lowell Show.
Every Tuesday and Thursday evenings right here on the Realm Network. And catch the Poor Premium Show Friday nights.